Binging on Movies with Rebecca and Jason.
Are you gonna love them or hate them?
Here comes the binge.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Binge, in which a couple of homos review the latest movies. I am Jason Leroy.
And I'm Rebecca Olarte, and we have four movies for you this week. Dune 2, Madam Web, Society of the Snow, and This Is Me Now. And as always, we're going to rate these movies on a three-tiered scale, with Binge It being our highest rating. Consume in moderation means it's okay, but it's kind of meh. And Send It Back means...
life is too short for that mess.
Jason, life is too short for that mess. We were just talking about how old you've become. And I guess also, in relatively, I have too. And as we finished up that little pre-conversation, I reminded myself that I needed to take off the beaded bracelet I bought in in Catalina because it would make too much noise for the podcast. And I see the exact desert lesbian I have become.
I thought you were going to say it was some sort of like medical bracelet. And yeah. You were like, oh, you're going to hear my blood pressure tags rattling if I don't take this off. But also, if I have a crisis, then call Saul, okay?
it's a bracelet that reminds me to take my vitamins. No, I bought jewelry on a vacation.
Yeah. 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 You're that. You are buying vacation jewelry. You are admiring it. you're saying, oh, I got in Catalina, whenever people ask.
Oh, next it's to this giant there. Painting of a boat that I have up on the wall.
You have the golf cart parked right outside the room, and you just hop on it and let it take you wherever the devil may.
That I would say, you know what? This is me now.
Yeah. So yeah.
Get used to it.
Yeah. If you guys want to hear This Is Me then skip back to our early episodes back in 2015. But this is me now.
Yeah.
Rebecca, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Like Lunar New Year?
If you can still say it in March, Happy New Year.
It's Q1. It's Fiscal New Year.
Happy Fiscal New Year. It's 2024. Our first episode of this sure to be exciting and not at all apocalyptic year. It's off to a great start, don't you think?
Is it?
Yeah. Well, one thing that has happened so far this year, while we've been on a scan, regularly scanned and pledged. This is scanned and pledged.
That was real? I think you're trying to be cute.
Scanned and pledged. planned and scheduled. Our planned and scheduled break is the Oscar nominations came out.
Oh, right.
Yay! For all the movies that we didn't review last year. a few that we did, many that we did not. Mm-hmm. And as we tape this, the ceremony itself is just a few days away. So we are going to go ahead and give some thoughts on the nominations just days before they're rendered irrelevant by the slow drumbeat of time.
You know, I was very confused when I first saw the nominees. Mostly because I had seen it like kind of cut off, and I thought that Coleman Domingo was nominated for Rust, and I was like, wait a minute.
Oh, no.
Wait a minute. That's not why. Wait, what? It's Rust.
They better not pin this on him. Typical Baldwin.
Exactly. Typical Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Coleman Domingo was nominated for Rustin and Best Actor. Are you rooting for him, Rebecca?
Always.
Of course.
Always.
We love Coleman Domingo. Let's see. I don't know. I guess we did review. Let's talk about some of the top nominees. So I think, we did review. We had a Barbenheimer episode. So that's two of the big ones right there. We reviewed Oppenheimer. We reviewed Barbie. We did review Maestro in our last episode. we reviewed May December, although it turned out that was a non-starter with the Academy. Let's see. Did we do the holdovers or no? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
Hmm.
I wish I had someone that actually listens to the show.
I know. If anyone's listening, just let us know what we talked about last time. We did review Saltburn last time. That did not get any nominations. Rebecca, were there any snubs that you remember being peeved about?
Snubs. I don't think so. I think I was pretty excited about Anatomy of a Fall. I mean, I feel like I was confused about some of the I guess I was expecting some of the nominations, but kind of confused. Mostly like around Barbie and Oppenheimer. But I'm very excited to see what happens with Bradley Cooper.
In what sense? Do you think he might wear some sort of like bomb vest to the awards if he doesn't win, or like, you know, what are we hoping happens with Bradley Cooper?
I mean, meltdown, public meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I don't hope that to happen, but
no.
You know, I'd watch.
Sure. I'd watch it. Yeah. I mean, will we all be like intensely studying his face when they have a little like five up of all the live camera feeds of the nominees for both best act for best actor only, since he was snubbed in best director? You know, yeah, we'll all be just really all eyes on Bradley's face as his name is not called in that category. I think you know, we're all excited to see what jokes are made about Maestro in the monologue.
Who's doing the hosting this year?
I believe it's Jimmy Kimmel again.
Okay.
Yeah. There's that. You know, I, on a scale of 1 to 10, what was your 10 being the most?
There was something I was upset about the snub, and I felt like a snub across all of the awards. And that's Ironclaw.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So we did not review Ironclaw.
No?
I don't think we did.
We did.
Did we?
Yeah, because remember we talked about how there was another death, but nobody would believe it.
Oh, wait. Now I'm opening our own podcast in the podcast.
Can you listen to the podcast last time?
I'm gonna go ahead and maybe just you just riff for a minute while I listen to the episode. no. No, we did not. No, our December episode
for 2 hours.
Our December episode was May, December, Saltburn, Eileen, and Maestro. And our last episode before that was October.
Get the hell out of here.
So we did not review the Ironclaw.
Wouldn't it be funny if like we regularly had a video chat every week where we talked about new movies, but we just didn't record it? I keep forgetting to hit record, and so we haven't published one.
That is the world's least desired Patreon.
No, Jason, you don't look old, I promise you. You just look a little haggard because you know what? You're doing too much, which brings us...
Oh!
Sorry, did you want to talk about the Oscars some more?
I mean, listen, I did want to ask on a scale of 1 to 10, your own personal rage level of the Barbie snubs, because, of course, that was the big story.
Oh, I don't know, 2?
Yeah, weren't really too bothered.
No, I guess I'd be more upset at the best director May-December snubs.
Yeah. Yeah, there was that very, very funny tweet that someone did whenever SAG also snubbed May-December. Where was a picture of the Euphoria finale whenever Alexa Demi's character is sitting in the audience at the play saying, wait, is this fucking play about us? And the tweet said, SAG voters watching May, December.
Nice. It is March 6th. You know what that means?
Tell me.
We are only 9 days away from the new season of Girls 5F.
Oh, okay, so this past weekend we went on a road trip to Las Vegas, and on my like shuffle playlist, what came on but I'm Afraid.
Nice.
It is just, we listened to it a couple times in a row. It is It is one of the most towering works of musical comedy that I have ever heard. And it truly slaps, because like the chords are so, like the chords really are just like, oh, these are powerful chord progressions. I'm getting emotional. And Sarah Bareilles sings the hell out of it. And the lyrics are about being worried about someone having sex with you after you're dead and saying it's not worth it. And being like, you're worried if you, you know, if you get real sick, you won't be brave, inspiring. You'll just be a real bitch and miserable to everybody. It's all of it. Oh, yes. I cannot wait for Return of Girls by Beva. What a gift. What a gift that we get more of this show. Yes. Is there any character you're especially excited to see what happens for them next?
Ooh, I know. I just I'm going to let go and let God.
Yeah. Yeah. Wiki. You mean Wiki?
Yes. Yeah. I said what I said. I mean, I would love to see maybe like a Dr. Spichemin come in there at some point. That'd be nice.
More but, Tina Fey multiverse work.
Yeah, that would be nice. But other than that, no.
Yeah. All right. Well. I will acknowledge briefly that I think we disagree on both Anatomy of a Fall and the Iron Claw. Ooh.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. We just review those so we can give the people the fight they've been longing for.
Yeah, they're both great, and Jason's dumb. And... Just kidding. Go on.
I mean, yeah, no, I mean, I really, the love for Anatomy of a Fall has left me just really kind of puzzled. You know, I watched it once in theaters and I was kind of like, okay. And then everybody was like, oh, it's like the best movie I've ever seen. I'm like, is it? And then I watched it with Scott and I told him nothing in advance. I didn't poison the well. And then he had the same reaction I did. You're like, yeah, he's dumb too. and we're...
You said that, not me.
I guess I just feel like it's not really doing anything particularly profound. I feel like it's just kind of like, it's just like a very long kind of court procedural movie that it doesn't pass the test that I like to do with foreign films sometimes, where I'm like, okay, if this was in English, which part of it is, if this was just an American movie in English, would this strike me as being like great art? Or does it seem more profound because they're like in Europe and they're speaking other languages? And I just didn't see how it would be that interesting if this was just an American movie. I felt like the story is sort of like needlessly opaque. I didn't really feel like the whole lesson of like, can you ever really know the truth? I'm like, oh, really? No shit. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's like a groundbreaking, you know, sort of takeaway for a movie to have. I think Sandra Hüller is wonderful. You know, I mean, like all the acting is great. I mean, it has to be because it's such a naturalistic screenplay. Mm-hmm. Since, you know, every bit of dialogue is so, I mean, like there's nothing is really trimmed or hurried along for the purpose of a movie.
He said fucking... with adoration.
He said glowingly. You're really in the trenches for all those courtroom scenes. I can't imagine, I know at least one scene in that movie that I can't imagine you enjoyed watching very much.
Sure.
Yeah, but of course then seeing that superstar making the rounds all through award season has been a delight.
You know I hate steel drums.
Yes, of course, and nor do you like PIMP historically.
Did you see A.D. Bryant hosting
the
Spirit Awards?
I sure did.
The part where they had the song playing at the intro, I forgot. That was so good. She's like, I'm sorry, my husband is like jealous I'm doing this. Just genius.
You're so fucking, yes. I mean, her also, just brief shout out to her entire like, hey, you stupid bitch.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Greta Lee, you're a slob and a slut and a stupid bitch.
She was wonderful. She was wonderful. I mean, you know, you have a soft spot for teenage coming of age movies and anything that involves like a half naked guy. And I have a soft spot for movies about justice. That's just how we differ.
Did you watch St. Omer last year? Sorry. Did you watch St. Omer?
good question. I feel like I did. You know, movie podcast hosts always say they all run together. Movies.
Yes, you know how movie podcast hosts always say, I don't really care for movies. I don't really
call me when they make a book about it.
It's all just in the background. I only bring it up because it's the movie I thought of the most when I was watching this. And if you didn't watch it, you really should, because it is also a French courtroom film that I think is I liked it better than Anatomy of Fall. But that's where I first learned that French courtrooms are the way that we see them in this movie. Yes. That they're so dramatic, but also so sort of conversational. But yeah, definitely watch Saint Omer if you didn't see it. But yes, go on.
There's just something that like is always fascinating to me about like the characterizations that people make about how people should act or who people are, all the things that kind of get left behind when something unexpected happens. All of a sudden, everything you've done, everything you've way you've acted, if you seem cold, if you seem warm, come to play in such a major way in your life. I think it's interesting, and I love people talking. You know, I love women talking. Mm-hmm. I love
sure
people talking.
Dogs talking.
And I enjoyed the opaqueness of it. And then Iron Claw. What do you have to say about Iron Claw? Come on, that appeals to both of us.
You would think so. I thought that it did not. I felt like it was actually too reverent toward the family to really go where it needed to go to be interesting, because the story of the Von Erichs is so fucking dark.
Mm.
And I felt like the movie wanted it to be uplifting still, because as we know, and as you alluded to, there's stuff they didn't even get into because they didn't want to get too dark.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, listen, the only interesting thing about this family is like the absolute nonstop biblical onslaught of tragedy that has befallen them for decades. You know, like, and I felt like the movie tried to like soften it a little bit.
I think because it would have been unbelievable.
Well, but that's the thing, is that it's true. So it would have had the truth on its side.
Mm.
You know, I feel like, you know, I felt like it just tried to be gentle with something, tried to soft touch some things. And for me, the final scene was just unforgivably cheesy. Like, just like I this is a movie that's made for the kind of people who like cry at movies about where you have like a sport and you have a father and a son. You know, it's a whole subgenre, father son sports movies, and this falls under that. Even though the dad is a bastard, and he really was the kind of mean old bastard you don't see in movies very much anymore. But you know. And it still ultimately is just a father-son sports movie. And, you know, with co-starring, you know, Lily James and Maura Tierney as women. you know, yeah, I just didn't think that it was. I thought, like, casting Zac Efron in a role depending entirely on his interiority when his exterior has never been more disrupting was a choice.
It was no Neighbors, that's for sure.
No, Neighbors it wasn't. And Jeremy Allen White still struggles to find a role, you know, that can sort of make use of him the way that the Bear does.
Right. For me, Zac Efron's interiority rose the whole movie up beyond the cheesiness of the feel-good movie and into a real story of torment between the trappings of family adoration and that dynamic, along with what'd you call it? The biblical onslaught of crises.
Mm-hmm, right.
But I guess you win. You got it snubbed from the Oscars again.
I mean, and I love Harris Dickinson too, you know, and then when he goes first, I'm like, okay, well, this movie's going downhill already.
Like, not the cute one.
I'm like, that's why I'm going to stick around. He's a little male model. I'm Triangle of Sadness. Come on.
Okay. I don't have another one. We're doing too much about other movies and not about the movies for the week.
Understood. Yes, yes. A bonus review is out of the way. Now down to the meat of the show.
For the first movie, Dune, Part 2. Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. Facing a choice between the love of his life and the fate of the universe, he must prevent a terrible future only he can foresee. I saw this movie on Monday, the Monday after it came out.
Oh, me too. So 2 days ago, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen a movie theater that crowded since 2019, if then even.
Really?
It was packed. So Lena Dunham was like, I didn't know there's like this room, this many straight men were in. It was like a bunch of dude friends together, like anywhere between like college age and like middle age.
Oh, wow.
And other smatterings of people, but it was packed and people were like cheering onto the screen. It was like, a step backwards in time.
Wow, it's like this like rigadoon of like straight maleness in Palm Springs. It's like this
every
it's
7 years.
It's like this brief mirage and everyone like, you know, it's like there it is and it's gone just as quickly. The credits roll and then it's just back to gays and grays. Wow.
Yeah, wow, so that was quite special. And it did have that feeling of, you know, it's also the kind of movie that has a lot of rallying of troops, rallying of partners, supporting the main character as he goes through his trials on his way to success, and everyone was feeling it.
Yeah, our theater was also full, and it did have people reacting to things, and people it would became quickly clear that there were a number of people in the theater who had already seen it multiple times, even though had just opened 3 days sooner. As we were walking out, we heard two people enthusing to each other that like, hits just as hard the second time. Villeneuve is the best director for this. yeah. So that was what I heard on the way out. I did you make any noises during the movie? Were you swept up in all the excitement?
Ooh, that's a good question. Did I make any noises during the movie? Like, well, I was talking on the phone to you most of the time. Does that count?
Like my tummy rumbled a little bit. Yeah.
No, I think I was mostly slack-jawed. More than speaking. We did see it in IMAX.
So you were drunk. Okay.
I was asleep.
Right?
Shit's long.
Great. So you took a few quick power naps to get through it, and then you came back and you're like, fucking pumped. Right, let's do this.
Yeah, let's get it, Timmy. Right. Wonka forever. And then I beat my chest. Loved it. Look, I'll say this.
Yeah.
I just bought a copy of the book.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there a picture of Oscar Isaac on the cover or something?
You should see my hair today. I sent you a photo and I'll tell you, we'll talk about why I sent you the photo later, but my hair today is like the most Oscar Isaac it's ever been. The most Leto Atreides, and I am loving it.
Oh. Mm-hmm. So you're letting him into the fold. You're acknowledging him once again.
Yes, we're back on.
Good. Yeah. Even the fact that you're willing to watch this movie, knowing that he wouldn't be in it. I mean, I don't know if you were holding out hope that he'd be in like a dream sequence or something.
A flashback.
He's just gone. He's just gone. It's like how do you just lose Oscar Isaac like that?
I like that. I mean, I think it's like, you know, very much in contrast to the pattern we've gotten into with like Marvel movies, which is like, but is he dead?
Right.
But
yeah.
There's a multiverse and like they're not doing that anymore.
No. Yes, that's a whole other Marvel in the free fall they remain in.
Right.
Put a pin in that. Did they show the Deadpool Wolverine trailer before your showing?
They did.
Yeah. And that's cute. I've always enjoyed the Deadpool movies.
Yeah, that'll be great. Does.
Yeah, we have another Marvel movie we can talk about later in this episode, but circling back to Dune 2.
And you mean This Is Me Now, which is truly a Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marvel us. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, so, yeah.
What did you think of Dune 2? Dune 1.
Sure. I did not care for it.
Okay.
I thought that it was very boring, and I did not understand a single word anybody ever said. And
did you see it in the theaters?
I think the first time I watched it at home.
Good. It was a lose-lose. I was going to judge you. I was teeing up to yell COVID denier, but go on.
Good. Yes. I assume most questions are in bad faith, so I was prepared either way.
Picture this. You're Claudine Gay, and I am grilling you in front of Congress. That's the tone. And go.
Always. I know you saw that, and you're just like, oh, I miss him. gotta get the band back together. So yes, and I know also I'm in your phone as Claudine Gay. So really the tracks. But no, I watched it at home with Scott because I was like, oh, this is like this big sci-fi epic. I watch it with Scott. He's into sci-fi, but we both were very, very bored by it. And then I even got the David Lynch version from, 84 or whenever it was that his version came out. Even though David Lynch has been unswerving in his position that it is not good and people should not watch it all these 40 years since it came out, there are still so many people who are just like, no, it's actually a masterpiece. And, it's like the undiscovered glory of cinema. So I watched it and I was like, oh, this is bad. This is real bad. I'm with DL on this one. This is not something that I would like to spend any more time with. And nor did it help me understand the new ones any better. So as Scott and I were driving back from Las Vegas on Monday, I was like, let me bring up the Dune movie Wikipedia for part one. And I will read the Wikipedia synopsis aloud so that Scott and I can both be caught up on it. It's the kind of thing where within like a sentence, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to follow this at all. It reminds me of like when I was first watching the Avengers and like the first thing they say is the Tesseract. And I was like, oh, fuck, I'm not going to get any of this. Here, this is the first sentence in the Dune 1 plot on Wikipedia. In the distant future, Duke Leto Atreides, ruler of the planet Caladan, is assigned by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV to replace Baron Vladimir Harkonnen as the fiefholder of Arrakis, a harsh desert planet and sole source of spice, a valuable psychotropic substance that imparts heightened vitality and awareness. No, I don't know any of that. I don't know any of those words. Not a bit of it. No clue. I get that Dune is sort of like, generally considered a bit more, considered more quote unquote hard sci-fi, where it's really kind of,
What is that hard sci-fi?
Hard sci-fi is a term I used to hear thrown around to describe sci-fi that was a bit more sort of like intellectually demanding. You're like, oh, dumb. You're not done. Your things that make you feel dumb. Got it. You're like, I'm a hard podcast host.
Go on. I'll never stop being the Brian, will I?
I was like, okay, well, but then I saw like all the, all the responses to Dune 2 were like so over the moon positive. I was like, oh, okay. And then so I told Scott, I'm like, I bought a ticket to see Dune 2. He wasn't interested, but he decided to go anyway.
Wow.
And so we go and, I liked it better than the first one. Because the first one, even diehard fans would admit the first one is kind of more kind of table setting. It's just basically it's doing just like 2.5 hours of setup so that this second movie can kind of, stick the landing and have all the exciting stuff. But I didn't think it was particularly exciting. I think it's just kind of not for me at the end of the day. I was resentful of how long it was. I thought it was still very slow outside of like the big action-y scenes. I didn't understand what was happening plot-wise. I was confused by sort of Paul's ascent. I was confused by like what we're meant to be thinking about, like what is true about this, you know, the visions and his calling and the holy war. And, you know, and I understand that probably a bit of that is meant to be a little ambiguous, which I can, you know, appreciate, you know, that like there's, you know, these different characters have different perspectives on Paul becoming this kind of leader and on and how, you know, Chani would feel about it versus how his mother feels about it. So, but yeah, I do think it's great that Austin Butler has been studying like the Jared Leto post 1998 career book of like, here's how I will make you take my pretty face seriously. I really enjoyed Stellan Skarsgård wearing a fat suit in a tub. That was great. Mm-hmm. that really, I felt myself in that. Yeah. Okay. Back to you. I don't have much more to say about old Dune 2.
Okay. Dune 1, I also saw at home. I was dreading it because it was long, and I don't have a lot of, like a particular interest in sci-fi. Although I know that I'm wrong in thinking that, because there are like certain sci-fi stories that are like my favorite of all time. Whenever I'm in a bad mood, I watch Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Oh,
it's like my when I need a North Star. Principles wise, it's where I go. The Matrix. So I do like it. I think
the MCU.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little different, but yeah.
I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy is pretty sci-fi.
Okay. Yeah. Fair. There's. I don't know why I say I have an aversion to it. I feel like it's almost because it can be so on the nose about humanity that like I feel like I can't take it, so I just say I don't like it. That said, this movie is also, this story is also exactly that. So I watched the first one again a little begrudgingly, and then I ended up really enjoying it. And even though I saw it at home, I was stunned by the visuals and really felt engrossed in the story that I also admittedly didn't completely understand. Although I did miss this time having the subtitles from the at-home viewing.
Ah.
This time, seeing it in IMAX, completely immersed. I thought that the action scenes were like riveting. The audio was just out of this world, both like the soundtrack and like the foley they used for the sounds of their weapons and the way that the sounds of when they moved. Love a good worm wrestle scene. I feel like we're we're lacking those in cinema.
Not since Beetlejuice, really.
Right? And how long ago was that?
That was almost 40 years ago.
Too long, Jason. Too long.
Yeah.
I think the hardest part of the movie for me was there were moments where I was like, this is a little campy. But the story is like working hard enough, and the sets are working hard enough to push past that. I think like Zendaya is like mugging for the camera a bit of like, I'm always looking a little like upset at the scene, became a little happening a bit much, where it was like, oh, she's mad again, you know? She has a very particular, like, same pouty. Sort of pouty face, yeah. Rebecca Ferguson. That's why you don't like this. Because they stole your name. Reverend Mother.
name.
I'm putting all the pieces together. I see.
Beyond that, you would think that I would actually love this even more, because it turns out that in the first movie, one of the voices of the Bene Gesserit is actually done by Marianne Faithfull.
Oh.
Who's my favorite singer of all time. So, you know, which almost was enough to make me go back and rewatch it. And then I don't know if she reprised it for this or not. I feel like there were less like Bene Gesserit voices this time around.
Yeah.
But yeah, Rebecca Ferguson, all famously known as the actress that we can just never remember on this show. because she just kind of looks like Ruth Wilson combined with about just 10 random actresses. And, you know, maybe I'll remember after this. I don't know. But, you know, yeah, I don't. I saw some story today that was like, oh, this movie actually takes what was one of the great movie mom characters in Dune Part One and then completely ruins her this time around.
I mean, her slow descent into madness is hilarious. Every time you see her, she's like a little more crazed. She's got a little bit more face drawing on. It's wonderful.
Yes, yeah, like, and I, having gone on vacation together, we know what it's like to watch a slow descent into madness. yeah, it's so funny. I didn't pick up on any camp in this whatsoever. It all just seems to be very somber and very, I mean, I feel like the only humor, and my audience laughed every time at like Javier Bardem and his like true believer antics, like just interpreting every single thing as like yet further confirmation of this, you know, glorious prophecy being fulfilled. But yeah, no, I mean, I see what you mean. I think Zendaya does do that pouty thing. To me, that's just kind of how she acts in everything. So I guess I didn't really think anything of it. Like,
but here,
you know,
it's like stands out so much because she's the only one that's having like that kind of very human, very like out of place reaction.
Yeah. Kind of, yeah, kind of sulky, angsty.
Yeah.
It's almost like, yeah, I mean, she's making like prue face, basically, you know.
She's doing a Euphoria scene in a 10,000 years in the future.
Basically, you're waiting for them to like cut to like her and like Hunter Schafer canoodling in a cave. just being like, oh, this is all so fucked. it's and I saw, you know, one review I was reading was like, oh, this movie, Zendaya finally gives the movie what the first movie was lacking, which is like an emotional core. So, you know, which I'm like, I guess, but yeah, I didn't feel, you know, she does have like her very big dramatic reaction shot in the big finale. When, you know, when there's a sort of key moment between Paul and the daughter of a visiting king,
the emperor,
I'm like, yeah, you know, king. And, you know, so, but yeah, no, it's to your point. It does seem like she is kind of acting in a different movie than everyone else. Like nobody else is giving you this sort of like, this kind of just basic human emotion reaction to things. And so it does in a way make her feel a bit anachronistic, but also I feel like the movie is like overall better for it.
I 100% agree. And like, she is representing a large group of people in the movie that are just like, they're just fighting and they're just trying to live and they're kind of caught up in this thing. And it's all this group of the Fremen that like Paul has, you know, invaded basically with his presence. This is how they were. They hang out. She has some other friends that are just like kind of, you know, normal run-of-the-mill Fremen, great warriors, right, but like just trying to get shit done. So it's not like she is, you know, I don't know, smoking a jewel by herself while everyone else is like trading spice. But I just thought it was kind of funny. I don't know.
I mean, if they offered spice in a vape, her character would be smoking that vape.
She's like, I'm on Zim.
No, it's very that. What did you think of Austin Butler?
Oh, I thought he had the Elvis voice.
Did you? Yeah. He still has it?
I think he still does.
He's trying so hard to do like Stellan Skarsgård's voice back to him, like blah 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 blah. Like, he's really trying. He's trying so hard to not have the Elvis voice. I feel like they even could have had like Stellan Skarsgård like ADR all his dialogue afterward to make him sound less like Elvis. I don't know. I saw.
You know how well that worked for Madame Web, so.
Yeah. I saw. I guess like Chalamet said something about how, because he's doing a movie where he plays young Bob Dylan. And I guess maybe it came up when he was like doing a junket interview along with Austin Butler, and he says something to him just like, oh, you know, he's like, oh yeah, I want you, I wish you could come and be Elvis in this movie where I'm playing Dylan. And I feel like that's like such a fucked up thing to say to Austin Butler. Like, to dangle the prospect of him like becoming Elvis again, because we know that like he has yet to come out of it.
Right.
And it's like becoming his unraveling as an actor. Is that
it's like telling an alcoholic, like, oh, I wish we'd go get a beer together after this.
Right. Yeah. I'm just like, Chalamet, you can't just like casually mention Elvis to him. You know, it's sort of like, it's almost like what Mommy Dearest was to Faye Dunaway. You know, it's a role that she just never shook. Like for the rest of her career, she has been Joan Crawford. Except for she had already been acting for about, you know, 15 years and had won an Oscar at that point. Austin Butler, we were just meeting as this was happening.
Just got to know him.
It's a tough one. Christopher Walken was a surprise for me to see in this. I did not know he was in it. Léa Seydoux, did not know she was in it. Florence Pugh, I did know, was in it, and I was living for her chainmail dress in the finale.
It was pretty epic. It was pretty epic.
It was very epic. Very epic. She did not have much to do in this movie, nor did Anya Taylor-Joy, for that matter. There's so many people in this movie, and I don't even think I realized. I thought, like, this was it. I thought this was, like, and this is the end of the Dune saga. And then as the movie ends, I'm like, oh, well, so I'm a fool. And I did not know that there is so much more. And then Scott was looking it up and he's like, oh, there's like 50 books. I'm like, great.
I think there are only like maybe six that are like written by the same artist. Written by the same author.
Oh, yeah. So his son like took over after he died or something.
I want to say so. But I'm excited to see the next iteration of this, kind of what happens. I think we just... You know, I think this works well as the vehicle for Paul's change, how he's reacting to the things that are happening to him at this time in his life where he goes from being a sheltered boy to having all this responsibility and decisions thrust upon him while completely surrounded by, I don't know, people who are either high on worm juice or... have their own agendas. So I'm excited to see where this, I feel like next episode will be, you know, more of who he's become, and I'm eager to see it. This is
where do you
be
think
a binge it for me.
Oh, okay. What Oscar chances do you think this movie has next year? Do you think this is going to be a big contender?
It's a tough time of year. So much left to happen. I think so though. I think so. I mean, it just came out and like, it might have some staying power.
Yeah.
It might stay on people's lips for a while.
Certainly. I mean, especially coming off of this year with the big return of just big studio, big budget epics that it pleased both critics and audiences alike. You know, if that trend continues next year, then this could certainly benefit from it.
This movie is leaps and bounds beyond Barbie and Oppenheimer. Leaps and bounds.
See, Ashley said the same thing. Ashley essentially said, like, she's like, Christopher Nolan should be thanking his lucky stars that the strike pushed this movie out of the year because this would eclipse Oppenheimer at the Oscars. So you concur.
Oh, 1,000%. Oppenheimer was such a disappointment. It was such a hacky biopic. I can't even believe that was like a Nolan movie. That could have been from anybody.
Wow. It's a consume for me.
Great.
on this one. but also, yeah, it's just not for me. That's all.
Dune 2 is in theaters now, and it is rated PG-13. Movie number two is Madam Webb. Cassandra Webb is a new... Wait, Webb? Like Webb, the daughter of... is a New York City paramedic who starts to show signs of clairvoyance. Forced to confront revelations about her past, she must protect three young women from a mysterious adversary who wants them dead. The photo that I sent to Jason is of the t-shirt that I'm wearing, which doesn't get enough... wear out of me, I'll admit that right now, but it is a very special t-shirt that in the top corner has a drawing of Dakota Johnson and the words, "Actually, no, that's not the truth, Ellen." Classic moment.
The beginning a moment of the that end. Changed the world. A moment that changed this world that we live in.
Yeah.
There was before that moment and there was after that moment.
That was it. Everybody, she pulled the plug on that one.
Yeah. And all of, and for some reason, all of the gays were just like, yes, we're going to get in line behind Dakota Johnson and take down Ellen.
Wait, is she behind the JVN thing right now?
Ooh. And once again, we're all in. We're like, yeah, take them down.
Drag her.
Yeah. Pickle people. Yeah. Ooh, Dakota she any Dakota Johnson press tour is guaranteed to be delightful because that was just her promoting something. That was just her going on Ellen to promote something. And look what happened.
You never know what's going to happen.
No, you really don't. You just know it's going to be like entertaining. You know that it's going to be worth listening to and that she will be hysterically unbothered and just really in no rush to curry favor or liking from anybody around her. She is just going to call it like she sees it in the way that only a true Nepo baby could.
It's so funny.
She's like, what's the worst that can happen? I lose my career. I don't even like acting.
Yeah. She's a Nepo baby of such a certain kind of celebrity, though. That is, she's just such the antithesis of their whole public persona. I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
I saw this movie, Don't Hate Me, yesterday. We were supposed to record the podcast yesterday. And I was like, I can't do it because I hadn't seen it yet. And I was like, if I let this go by without seeing it, let me just ask. And then you were cool with it because you always are because you're the best and you're so flexible and I appreciate it. And I got to see it and I cannot believe it was still in theaters. And
I'm shocked.
Yeah, you told me like 2 weeks ago, you should see it now because it's going to be gone. But you know, Palm Springs, I feel like there's an audience for this one. And we went into the theaters and we were like, I wish I had just dropped off my ballot. So I was wearing my I voted sticker. And so I was like, I wish we had a sticker like that that says, like, I've already seen Dune. So people don't think that we're willingly choosing to see Madam Web right now on like Dune opening weekend. I was a little embarrassed. Because once again, the theater was packed, like in the lobby, people clearly going to see Dune on the Tuesday.
You're we were there seeing the judgy eyes of strangers, just watching you reproachfully. Yeah, well, I mean, like, you're like, see, I got the popcorn bucket. Oh, look, I'm moving my hand. Yeah,
can you see all these scars on my arm?
Yeah, I left it in the freezer. It is. Oh, what a dream. I mean, I have loved Dakota Johnson for so long. You know, I feel like she is just truly a one of a kind fixture on the pop culture landscape. And like I remember the first time that I think I really realized that I loved her was she was on the Oscars red carpet with Melanie Griffith around the time that maybe after the first 50 Shades had come out. And the journalist is like asking Melanie Griffith like the obvious questions about like, oh, you know, like, so how is it having your daughter in these, you know, in this like, you know, raunchy movie? And you know, Melanie Griffith is just like, well, you know, I have always tried to tell her that sex is a beautiful thing. And then Nicole Johnson is just like fully like knowing that she's on camera, just not caring. It's like, Mom, shut up. She's like, God, shut up. And Melanie's like, okay, honey. And she's like, stop talking. Why are you talking? And she's not like hiding this from the camera. She is just like openly berating her mother on camera. And I'm just like, this is a girl after my own heart. I was like, okay, I would follow this woman anywhere. And, you know, and she is such a distinct kind of actor. Like, I'm not of the school of thought that she's a bad actor.
Did you see her on Saturday Night Live?
I did, yes.
Are you sure you still believe that?
In the pre-tapes, she was great.
Yeah, in the Please Don't Destroy video, she was... Destroy video was amazing, by the way.
Yes, it was. No, in the pre-tape with like the talk show backstory was also great. But all the timing was off in general. Like all the actors were kind of like hitting very kind of stilted in their timing on the live ones on that night. It was definitely off. But I mean, because, like, this is somebody, I mean, she's been cast in not one but two Luca Guadagnino movies. Like, this is somebody who, like, is appreciated by, you know, some of the great filmmakers of the world. She's in The Lost Daughter. She's great in that. I loved her in Cha-Cha Real Smooth. Mm-hmm. She is, like, there's stuff that she's good in. There's stuff that she shouldn't be in. Like, I remember when she was in that Jane Austen Persuasion adaptation on Netflix. And, like, all the reviews were just, like, her face does not belong in a movie where an iPhone is not pointed at it.
No. Not at all.
It's not believable. The 50 Shades movies were not her fault. There is not an actor who would have been able to, like, make that character seem like some kind of genius. You know, like, the material was dreadful, and she was once again openly miserable while she was making it. And she hated Jamie Dornan, and he hated her. So, you know, it's so, because I feel like at the end of the day, she's a great reminder that, like, acting and movie making is all kind of silly. And she's just like, yeah, it's silly. It's make-believe. Like, who gives a fuck? And, you know, and now she has had the absolute, like, nadir of her career with Madame Web. and she's already given an interview saying that she'll never do anything like this again.
Right.
and I think we're all worse off for it, because I feel like whatever performance art she was doing in this movie, just really had me going. Me and Scott saw this opening night, which was Valentine's Day.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And it was like, it was, you know, we went in, of course, like, you know, collectively, we were all, as a culture, like, anticipating Madame Web being probably, like, at least a little campy. Maybe not the best movie, if only because she's in it. And I feel like that's the thing. You see her involvement, just from the trailers, people were like, something about this doesn't feel like it's going to work.
Well, there was already the whole thing about he was with my mother.
Right, yes.
The Amazon. the most awkward line reading of all time.
I think Spider before she died. And then the line is not even in the movie.
I know, but you can see exactly where it was supposed to be.
You can. You do still get to see her say, "I hope the spiders were worth it, Mom." and then she feeds the cat and says, "Us strays got to stick together."
And then immediately leaves them. Oh, we're all orphans? We got to stick together. Bye. Yeah. As well, toxic plays going down the road.
She abruptly leaves a lot of people. Like, there's that endless scene of her chest compressioning that guy on the crash site, where she, like, sees her coworker and friend die about 14 times in a row in front of her and does not connect that it's going to happen and she should stop it. And the entire time she's just chest compressioning this one man
for so long.
You assume must be in really bad shape.
And he's fine. Abruptly,
and then she just stops and she's like, "Okay, sir, you're fine."
And then he just gets up.
He just gets up. I mean, this movie, like, so we're going into it. And, like, I'm starting to get, like, the giggles from various, like, you know, sort of campy failures early on in the movie. And there's a guy next to me who was starting to laugh quite a bit as well. And as my laughter is building throughout the movie, and Scott at first is like, he's like, "Calm down." He's like, he's like, "Okay, you're laughing." You're like, he's like, "Shh." He's like, "People could be here who are, like, really trying to enjoy this." But as the movie went on, and it got, like, just more and more inexplicable with every choice it made, like, the whole theater was just laughing.
Oh, that's nice. And
by the end, like, by the finale, you know, where, like, all the visions of, like, the S or whatever, like, are failed by the fact that it's ultimately a big red P that crushes the villain. you know, people were just openly just, like, screaming with laughter throughout the whole auditorium. It was like one of the best movie going experiences I've ever had.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Happy Valentine's. It was so special. We had such a good time, especially with every person who'd appear that you're like, "Emma Roberts is in this? Adam Scott is in this? Zosia Mamet shows?"
Zosia, yeah.
Yeah. Like, what are you doing in this movie?
What is she doing? It's also very unclear what her job is.
Yeah, it really is. So, yeah. So walk me through you guys' response to this.
So we had been following all the conversation, and then we were kind of ramped up to see it, and then we didn't, because we had started to read some things that were like, I think the opinions of people who were more just like overall upset that this happened, because it's not just her. There are so many problems with this movie that it clearly is some kind of issue with either Sony or the director. And it's like, oh, all this money again going towards these movies, like, let's not support it. Let's wait till it comes out on video. That'll be just as fun. And then This Is Me Now came out. And so we were like, this will work instead, which it did. Oh, it did. And then as we were talking about the podcast, I was like, no, I got to do it. I got to see it. Like, mm-hmm. I need to see it. And I didn't have the experience. I think it was still open because on Tuesdays it's like $5 night at the theater nearby. So I think that's why people were there. And so they weren't into the full camp of it. I wish I had seen it earlier with, you know, a more fun crowd, because we did laugh. I was expecting a lot of the things. Again, like I had read a bunch about it before. Right. But I was also, I was so surprised still and so tickled. Like, I think the thing that I was surprised the most about is that we know who she is. We knew who she was going to be. We heard the line reading about the spiders. But I sort of thought it was going to be that she was just this like terrible fit for this character. But knowing that her character is like that, I was loving it. I was loving it. I was thinking about this, what we're going to talk about today when I was brushing my teeth. I had not yet at that point thought about or remember that we were doing Society of the Snow. So I thought it was going to be Dune 2, Madam Web, and This Is Me Now. And I was like, oh, it's like the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Like,
where, the cannibals. Yeah, right.
People,
yeah.
This Is Me Now is the lovers.
Sure.
Dune 2 is the dreamers. And then me is like some fucking idiot who like doesn't belong in this movie and doesn't want to talk to anybody and doesn't want this drawing from a kid. And is just like so over every minute, every scene she has, she's complaining about what she has to do. She's like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to take care of you. I don't want to be an EMT. I don't. She's just over everything. And I love it.
I did think it really worked at the baby shower scene. Oh,
I thought that she, yes. When she's talking about, no, like she goes into the whole story about her mother.
Yes.
Amazing.
That really worked. I was like, I'm like, this is actually funny on purpose, I think.
There's also a scene where she's like testing out this like clairvoyance. It's pretty early in the movie, and she like a bird runs into the window, and then she like opens the window to test if the bird's gonna hit it or not. And oh, spoiler alert, it doesn't. And she gives this little face of like, huh, what about that? It's like she's figuring it out. I'm so bought into this character who is a woman who does not want to be here, but still has to do this stuff. I love it.
It's all I ever wanted. It's superhero who is just a woman who doesn't want to be here.
It's perfect.
This movie gave me that. I mean, in that way, it is the most perfect casting it could have had. It really, even that Onion headline, Dakota Johnson hoping she doesn't get any Madam Web questions at Madam Web press event.
She was the thing that worked the most. Everything else in this movie, the shots and their constant zooming in and out are nonsense. The special effects, her when she like breaks into three, like are so terrible. It looks what is that hair brand?
Tresemme.
The one that's like green, it's like kind of tropical.
Botanical something.
Yes, herbal botanicals. Herbal essence. Like an herbal essence commercial filter on all of her like scenes. the three girls look both like children and adults. Sydney Sweeney looks like Abby Flynn. I just kept expecting you to say I'm a sexy baby.
I know. Why? The entire movie, she is styled like a stripper playing a shy schoolgirl character moments before the reveal, but the reveal never comes. She's wearing that wig and glasses and like buttoned up blouse and pleated skirt and knee socks the whole time.
We had just seen Bowen Yang talk about her heavy naturals.
Yes. Yeah, right.
It was so awkward. The weird sound effects, like the music would be too quiet when they were like walking through the forest and they would get loud at the wrong time. It's like, no, this is, it was such a mess. So her, she was the best part of the movie by far. And the last 5 minutes.
I mean,
her in that chair.
The reveal of her with, yes, with the covering over her eyes. It's just,
when she says, I see you. Yes. I see. I think I pulled a Jason. I was like, ah.
That was the moment that my audience started screaming. Just full voice screaming. Her powers remind me of the Family Guy when, like, the family kind of turns Avengers and Meg's power is to grow her fingernails a little faster.
It's so out of. Oh my God. Yeah. They're like, we brought home the Chinese food. And she's like, I know. Bless. Like, she's so tonally different in a. It's amazing. It's amazing. The glasses, it's everything is perfect. No notes, Jason. I never say this. No notes.
Yeah. No. Scott sent me this infographic from Twitter that he found. It says, all these events happen to Madame Web except one. Can you guess which is the lie? Madame Web is born in a cave in Peru with the help of magic spider people. The three spider women never get powers and are only seen in costumes during dream sequences. Evil Spider-Man is killed by a large Pepsi sign. Madame Web becomes wanted for kidnapping by the NYPD.
Oh my God. When she's like yelling at them, like, because you told them. Oh my God.
Madame Web runs down Evil Spider-Man in her car twice. Madam, as you said, Madame Web inexplicably splits into three ghost-like copies of herself near the end of the movie. And Peter Parker is born, but not named.
When she comes back to the house and, like, for some reason, like, the camera focuses that she, like, looks at the water breaking on the floor. It's like, what the fuck? Why did you do that?
And the answer is that the infographic is kidding. All those things happen in the movie.
She tries to climb up a wall. When they first see him and they're like, oh, that's the problem. And he's just like climbing on the seat. Our words can't say, and you should see this movie. This is a binge it.
Oh, hard binge it.
Hard binge it.
Right. This is hard sci-fi. Hard. This is like hard camp. This is
hard camp. Yeah. This is like a, if we know each other, like, and like we talk and you haven't seen it, like you should see it before we talk next.
Yeah. No, it is like, I cannot wait to watch it again. It is truly delightful. And I have told everybody I know to watch it. Yeah. And I mean, I feel, you know, badly for those on the inside who were fucked over by, like, the creative nonsense of executives, which is what executives do. And this is just like, and just the fact that this was meant to be like the beginning of like a whole new franchise and another like valiant effort by like the Sony leg of Marvel to be like, we're here too. And boy, oh boy, did they not make anybody happy over in old Feige's office with this one.
Oh my God, the way that it starts off with like the Marvel credit stuff, like, and then it's like, you know, very clearly says like a Marvel co-production or something, or
right,
something. It's like, okay, we get it.
And I mean, just like what a minor role. I mean, like even the very thought to take such a minor character from the comics and like build an entire origin story around her, when even like the characters who she begets like are themselves like not a huge deal. Like, it's just like all the choices involved here are just like mystifying, and I think it's a movie that will live in infamy.
Yeah, it's a binge it.
Yeah,
it's in some theaters still, so
yeah.
If you can, you should catch it. And it's rated PG-13. Movie number 3, Society of the Snow. In 1972, an Uruguayan flight crashes in the remote heart of the Andes, forcing survivors to become each other's best hope.
Best hope for dinner?
Oh. Wow, this was like the serious movie, Jason. I can't.
I know. I'm still feeling all goofy from Madame Web. You're like, I even changed into my serious voice when I read that.
Look, I'll tell you what happened. I watched this movie earlier today.
Yeah, by earlier today, I mean 5 o'clock tonight.
And we were originally going to have either pork or chicken for dinner. And I said, let's make vegetables and pasta, please. And so we ate vegetables and pasta instead.
See, this movie encourages a plant-based diet. So in that way, it's responsible. This was like one of two, when we were figuring out movies we want to talk about on this podcast, I think we had like two movies that were nominated for Best Foreign Language Film that we were considering. And you wanted this one. Was there anything in particular that inspired that choice?
I think maybe because it was like a Uruguayan film with a lot of Argentinian actors. And also because this is a story that I feel like I know the urban legend of, but that it was time I got to know the real story. It wasn't. I should have just stuck to the urban legend. I wasn't prepared for this.
No, this is not an easy watch.
And, like, when you think about this sandwich of, not to make a joke, but like when you think about this pairing,
just the bones of
this setup. We have Dune 2.
Sure.
You had these spectacular sets. You have Society of the Snow. I also watched The Little Like on, because this is on Netflix. They have a little Netflix 30-minute thing about how they filmed it.
Oh,
they had
yeah.
like five different mm-hmm. versions of the plane, and like,
oh boy,
one of them was up on a snowy mountain in Spain. One was like on a the gimbal thing that moves around. You know, they have shots of the Andes. This movie is like majestic in its bigness yeah. and also in its smallness. And the thinking about the difficulty of the placement of like all of these shots have roughly like 10 guys in them, right? Like mm-hmm. somewhere between 10 and 24 men all need to be acting in their spots and doing the thing like over and over and over again. And then you look at Madame Web and you're like, oh yeah, that is a fucking waste of money. It's like, here are the things that the imagination and ingenuity can produce. And it's like Society of the Snow, Dune 2, and then it's like Madame Web. She didn't even want to be there.
Well, listen, you know, at least Madame Web is original. This story was already told in 1993's Alive with such inspired casting as Ethan Hawke as Nando Parado and Josh Hamilton as Roberto Canessa.
Wow.
Yes. But here we are. Here we are with this telling of the same story, with all of the beautiful and terrible developments in film technology since then, to make all of it so much more harrowing
right.
than it was 31 years ago. Yeah. Yeah. Did you see Alive when it came out?
I did not. Did you?
I did, and I had the book too. I bought the little movie tie-in.
You were like, "Oh, there's 14 guys stuck on a."
I'm gonna go on. It's gonna get sexy at some point. Little did I know, if I just wait for this one, this movie gives us some dick. So there's that. So I did appreciate that, but yeah, no, I did not realize when I first started seeing this movie title pop up as like an Oscar contender. I had no idea what it was. And I certainly didn't realize that it was the you know, that same story of that soccer team. Nor did I realize
rugby.
It was...
nor did you realize it was actually rugby.
Nor did I realize it was rugby, for that matter, until Czech's watch just now. I did not realize it was directed by J.A. Bayona, who did the movie The Impossible, which, similar to this, is just the kind of disaster movie that leaves you feeling just as though you have actually experienced what his characters have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
That was the tsunami
movie, right?
Film
yeah.
with Naomi Watts and, yeah, Ewan McGregor and young Tom Holland. Then he went on to do, for some reason, he directed Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Try not to hold that one against him. And now he's kind of come back to his roots with this film, with Society of the Snow. This is the kind of movie where I could say, you know, with absolute, you know, confidence that there's not a thing wrong with it. Everything is incredibly done, every performance, every moment. And yet I would never tell anybody to watch this ever, 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 ever. It is so much more hard to watch than I anticipated. Starting with the crash scene itself is it's the most graphic depiction of what happens when a plane crashes that I have ever seen.
I was not expecting that was. I don't know who I would tell to watch that. I feel like if you don't have a fear of flying, you might after this. Unless you are like a very physics minded person and you think about what happens to things when they're in different compromised positions.
If you're a sicko, then you'll think it's great.
If you are, I don't know, like someone who studies car crashes, if you're an insurance adjuster, sure, maybe you're ready for this. But I was shook.
Yeah, of course it happens very quickly because it happens, you know, with what's attempted to be, you know, realism, where these things would happen very quickly. And then watching what can happen so quickly to so many people was very upsetting. And then little do we know, those people are getting off easy.
Yeah.
compared to what the survivors go through. And like, this is a movie that really, you have to go through quite a bit with these characters before you get like the sort of the carrot of hope dangled over you, you know, at the very end. And even though, and this is a movie this is nearly 150 minutes long. And I would say that it takes until maybe the final, what would you say, 15 minutes?
15, yeah.
For things to start to turn around. You know, because I knew, even watching it, having already watched Alive and knowing that like there are survivors, it still manages to be so just bleak and punishing, but just like just tragedy upon tragedy upon tragedy. Of course, the arc of, you know, their agonizing, desperate survival decision to begin to, you know, eat the bodies of their former friends and family. Things seem like they're going okay, and then an avalanche comes tearing through the plane, and then they're once again stuck. And you know, it is like there are people who are out there who like really get off on like, we'll call this one hard survival. if you're into hard survival movies, then this is for you. I don't know if there's ever been a harder survival movie than Society of the Snow.
I don't think so. And once again, just maybe think about like, why do people like hiking? This is like, yeah, go tell one of these guys that you like hiking. Get the hell out of here. there's also like one of the most just soul crushing moments is when they hear that the Chilean government has called off the search for them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. That hits so hard.
Yes. And, you know, and it made me, I was like, it was like after like a week or something. I was like, I don't know how hard that Chilean government was looking. I really, they're just all at home watching Night Terrors.
Well, I mean, it's like, we can't do it on Thursday. That's the new episode of Night Terrors.
we can't miss it. This is the 70s. We have no way of watching it. We don't watch it live.
I do appreciate that this movie did not focus on the like cannibalism part. It was so much more than that. And I think
it's a focus of it, but it's not the focus.
Right, right. It becomes part of one of the many things that they have to do. And I thought that was a really great choice. And it like really, I don't know. It also made it like a lot more like relatable. It wasn't like, well, look at this crazy thing. You know, it's like, okay, these things are happening and you're now watching it for as long as they've been there. So this movie is 71 days long. And you're like, well, okay, what do we do now?
Mm-hmm.
You're able to kind of get into that headspace, I think, a little bit more.
Yeah, one thing it also, and I thought this is what you're going to say, one thing it also does not do is relieve the tension by taking you back to like back to civilization.
No, it didn't do flashbacks in the middle.
Yeah, it does neither flashbacks nor is it checking with like their loved ones or with the school or with the area. You know, it does not leave the site. It does not leave the survivors. It keeps you as the viewer trapped with them. It does not release you from that tension at any point, which is part of what makes it so hard to watch. Because it does not. It's all tension, no release.
And it's like they do such a good job of humanizing these people. And I did think that the sort of the lead up, the part kind of prior to the plane crash maybe could have been a little bit longer, but then the movie would have been 3 hours long. So I guess I understand why they didn't. And you get to know who they are in this scenario. But when a situation is this drastic and this dire and this like, unlived by so many other people, right? These starts to feel like these are like mythical men. They're, you know, there's these crazy guys that, you know, ate each other and like, but they're not. They're like just a sports team that was going on a trip. They were in college. Some were engineers. Some were medical students. Some were just friends and cousins. And they went on this little weekend trip and it changed who they were for more than 3 months. And I think the movie really was very respectful and made me never want to go on vacation again.
No. If it requires flying over snowy mountains, that's for sure. And this movie, I think it reminds me of where I think this movie succeeds in a way that I think the Iron Claw doesn't, because this movie is completely, completely unflinching in depicting the horror of what these people go through. And that makes the sort of like the uplifting finale feel that much more earned. Whereas I think the Iron Claw ironically pulls its punches a little bit.
Oh.
And then just kind of gives us this kind of like, oh, look, his sons tell him it's okay to cry. Let's throw the ball around. You know, it's...
You took that personally. Like, is it okay to cry, Jason?
Exactly. I'm just like, no, it's not. Don't listen to them. So, yeah. Yeah, no. I think that, you know, this movie really, 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 really is the most uncompromising, unflinching thing. It shows, you know, the things it shows are, you know, it is tasteful, no pun intended, in its depiction of the survival cannibalism. But it also shows like some like just the fucking bones just like piling up. It's like, ugh! It shows a lot more than I remember from Alive. It's unflinching, which in a way, like if you're really going to honor what these people went through, then you kind of have to show the whole thing, you know, like this is it's amazing. And at the end of the day, it is still weirdly inspiring to know that somehow that many of them survived 71 days.
It's wild.
In the harshest, most like unsparing possible conditions.
And Madam Webb couldn't last 5 minutes taking care of those girls.
Imagine if that's who showed up was her as a paramedic when they finally
just driving that stolen cab through the Andes.
Does anyone need chest compression?
It's like, can anyone point me to Peru?
Trick question. You all do. Scott coined the term Chekhov's chest compression.
A plus.
But yeah.
Oh my God, when she's reading her mom's notebook. Oh my God, when she visits her mom in her dream and she was like, but I don't have a neuromuscular disorder. Hilarious. Okay, side note, not hilarious. And like for as uncompromising and as real as they make the most off-putting or difficult or kind of grotesque things about the movie, including, you know, multiple injuries, the before mentioned cannibalism, it's also like mostly not a graphic movie. except for that kind of that plane crash incident, like there are long stretches of time where this is about men talking.
Right. I mean, it's about, they really do, you know, they it gets into faith, you know, there's a lot of discussion mm-hmm. of faith, because of course they're all, you know, questioning how this could be allowed to happen to them. And you have the character who is sort of like the devout one who won't engage in the cannibalism. And we're sort of left as a viewer to contemplate, like, you know, his decision, their decisions, you know, like it's really, yeah, it's very sort of philosophical. You know, in the discussions that we see them all have. So yeah, it definitely gives you more than just like, you know, like, oh, these are just like anonymous characters who we don't know. You know, like they're able to make sort of like compelling character rich dialogue, you know, out of these people as we get to know them. And we get to know, you know, it does a good job also of helping us get to know people who die between mm-hmm. when they land and when they're rescued, because you know, there's a number of people who survived the initial crash who are not, sadly, still alive by the time that they are found. You know, so, and the film is very respectful in the sense, you know, gives each person as they die, gets sort of like their name and the dates of birth and death come up on the screen, how old they were, just the age, just the, you know, how young some of the people were who died in this.
Mostly young.
It's interesting. I think there are also people who are seeing this movie who don't have a lot as a reference, who think it's just like, oh, it's like Yellow Jackets. I'm like, no, Yellow Jackets is like this.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, this is a true story that happened in the 70s and was already a movie in the 90s. So Yellow Jackets is really more inspired by this. Somebody took that idea and we're like, let's make it about a bunch of teenage girls in the 90s. And that's how you have Yellow Jackets.
Right, right. Society of the Snow, for me, it's one of those rare combinations that's both a binge it and a do not see it.
Yep. 100%.
I hope it gets seen by the right people. If you are up for it, it's a tough one, but it will be worth it.
Yes. Agreed on all the above. It is, you know, yeah, binge it, never watch it. It is not going to be, you know, it is, as we mentioned, is nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars. It's expected to lose that to the Zone of Interest. But all the same, it is nominated. And I would not deprive it of that nomination. And I think all of us who have watched deserve a nomination of our own, just to thank us for putting ourselves through this. Where's my nomination?
That's your takeaway. I mean, it's truly a feat. It is streaming on Netflix and it is rated R. Don't see it. It's wonderful. This brings us to our last movie of the week, which is another tale, harrowing tale of people overcoming the odds in life. This Is Me Now. This film chronicles the highly scrutinized love life of actor and singer Jennifer Lopez, including her relationship and personal healing journey. This little get together with our little gay friends in town that came over, and we watched This Is Me Now, and it was perfect. You know, when the vibes are right, it was like, you know, basically you've been replaced. everyone's on, everyone's making jokes, everyone is, but this is her, that was her then, when her as a child shows up. It was just...
You're like, you had to be there.
You can hear all about it on my other podcast that I do with these friends in town called Me and My Gay Best Friends.
It's called The Band.
Was it last year that she also dropped us a Valentine's Day treat, or was that mid COVID? I don't know. Sometime in the past couple of years, right?
I don't. Which treat are you thinking of?
That like streaming movie that she released on Valentine's Day.
Oh wait, the greatest love story ever told.
Is that it? When she did that like live event where like people were getting married in real time in like Vegas.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, there's like Vulture has this whole article called like the Jennifer Lopez Wedding Industrial Complex. just sort of goes back through her entire career and like all the many different like wedding focused things that she's done. Because she had that movie Marry Me that came out with Owen Wilson.
Yes.
And
yes.
Maybe, yeah, she probably did a promo for that where, because that was the whole like wedding stunt movie. Yeah.
Right. Yes, that was it. Was it last year?
I don't even know. It truly is like every year there's like a J-Lo wedding thing. The hilarious thing, one of the hilarious things about this is that she then followed This Is Me Now up with a documentary about the making of it called The Greatest Love Story Ever Told. And the documentary is half an hour longer than This Is Me Now.
I did not see that.
Yes, This Is Me Now clocks in at an hour. And then there's an hour and a half documentary about the making of This Is Me Now. And also just like it's more of like a warts and all direct documentary about J-Lo and her like her healing journey and all of her romantic trauma and all those things. And this is like her third such, like she's put out a number of documentaries over the last couple of years.
I did see the documentary about the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It took me a while to watch that one just because I knew it also got into the Hustler snub. And, I couldn't, I'm still raw over that.
Sure.
And, it was just as devastating watching it again this time, especially as they're like getting closer and it seems like it's going to happen. And,
yeah.
You know, we all remember where we were. But now she's you know, just doing just normal, healthy things like self-financing a $20 million passion project because she got back together with Ben Affleck. And I couldn't be happier that she's doing this personally. Who am I now? Happy. Grateful.
A friend of mine saw her and Ben at the garden store, and then later that day I saw the tweet of her and Ben, or my friend was like, oh my god, I just saw Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck at the garden store, it was crazy, he was wearing a flannel, she had her hair up in a clip, and then I saw the tweet of them collecting their trash after seeing Dune.
So
it must have been the same day because they were wearing the same outfits. So it's like we're all that was probably a documentary. My friend was inadvertently in a documentary about Jennifer Lopez going to the garden store.
Yeah.
Going to see
Dune. My friends were just talking about this today that like the pictures of them leaving Dune, like her popcorn bucket is like weirdly full.
Yeah.
Like, did they go back for a refill of popcorn? Like, did they finish it and need like a second popcorn? And then they're like, oh, no, we're full. or was it just for show? Was it just like, yes. And now we get our props of large popcorn, large soda. And then we just like set them on the floor and watch the movie. I would absolutely watch a documentary about what it takes for Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck to go to see Dune 2. Like, I feel like the Secret Service are involved. I feel like it just has to be a whole thing.
They got to get escorted in.
Yeah, no, I'm deeply fascinated by that. What garden store? Where?
Somewhere in LA. I don't remember the name of it.
Amazing.
So keep your eyes out. You might be in a documentary.
Oh, I will. I will. This movie is kind of in a trend of sorts of there's been such this rash of these sort of quote unquote documentaries about musicians that have come out over the last like 5-6 years. They're like, oh, these are like a tell all kind of moment. You know, like there's a Lizzo one, there's Lil Nas X one, Billie Eilish, Selena Gomez. It's these sort of like, you know, these interesting kind of would be documentaries, except, you know, the artist usually has like, you know, kind of control over what's being said. So it sort of comes across like these efforts to be like, no, I'm being very vulnerable and real with my public. But then it also sort of feels just a little PR-ish, you know, at the same time.
But this is, you're not talking about the documentary, right? We're talking about This Is
I know.
Now.
No, I am. And that's what makes This Is Me Now interesting. Because rather than just like go down that road, or rather than go down the road of like, let's say like Beyonce with Lemonade, which is, I guess, probably the closest relation to this in terms of like making essentially a visual album of this new record, except for it does not have all the songs, I don't think. It has just a smattering of them. And, you know, if there's one thing that Lemonade was missing, it was an all-star panel of astrological signs weighing in on the proceedings, which really Lemonade was worse off for not having featured Jane Fonda and Kim Petras next to each other, kikiing about what J-Lo is up to in her love life.
It's funny the comparison of this movie and Lemonade, because it was sort of, you know, kind of made when it was came out, like in the style of Beyonce's Lemonade as like a movie album, album movie. In that Lemonade was this like visuals that represent the themes of the songs and also use space to speak out about things in the world and injustice and bring in people to like show them respect. In particular, people who are next of kin and victims of police brutality or violence. This movie completely centers Jennifer Lopez and and has all of this like panel of celebrity astrological signs, and they're just up there talking about her. Just talking about her love life. It is the complete opposite in terms of scope.
It is just big Leo energy.
There's some great lines in that also about like never trust a Virgo or whatever.
Yeah, right. And that's Beyonce. Beyonce's a Virgo.
That's true.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like we're meant to believe like the universe is quite literally focused on Jennifer and her love life.
That's it. They're all in.
Yeah, I want to know who, if any of them, were in the same room.
Absolutely none.
Not a one. I mean, with that said, props to Kiki Palmer for managing to still be so funny, even though she was presumably alone on a green screen wearing this ridiculous outfit. I'm just picturing, like, what was going through Jane Fonda's head when she woke up that day?
I don't
know. Today I have the Jennifer Lopez film. I play a star sign.
There's also, the Post Malone, and then of course the, oh my God, what's his name? Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, sure. No, it's a real who's who. Wow, it's a real who's who.
That's a big part of the movie. There's another part of the movie that I think. I feel like you need to do, if you haven't seen this or Madam Web, you just got to do a double header. You got to get some gummies, get all your best gays together. If you and your gays haven't seen it, then yeah. I don't know what's going on with that. Check in on everybody. Mm-hmm. That seems like a problem, but you need to get together and just watch these two. The scene where she goes to the, Love Addicts Anonymous group, is just, It's just out of this world. The choices made when you just have $20 million to just do whatever you want. It's amazing. And I hope you have one friend that's like really insistent on trying to explain how the heart factory works. Because good luck. But I like when people try to explain it. Like, does it reduce the petals, or does it the petals from somewhere else? Is it like a horizontal thing?
The heart factory scene. I want. And I guess I need to watch The Greatest Love Story Ever Told, the documentary, to see if they get into just the creative development of the Heart Factory, like in terms of building the set and just conceptually realizing all those details of it. And also, like, do we think that J-Lo knows about the Sleater-Kinney song Heart Factory? Because I feel like they're owed some sort of kickback in all of this. The Heart Factory scene is certainly one of the most sort of surreal, trippy, mind-blowing elements of this film. We have her in sort of like a hot-headed, abusive relationship. These are just, each set piece is somehow more like unhinged, but also very earnest than the last. this is really her, sort of opening herself up for the world to be like, this is who I am. This is a scared little girl inside of me. This is my inner child. Be nice to her. And look, I'm back with Ben and we're good. Ben Affleck, who plays a sort of a semi-doomsday TV personality in the film, and who then allows the lower third of his face to appear in its final seconds, like some sort of like kind of cameo. I just wonder also, like, even though like they are one of the most definitive couples of like our lifetime, I still just can't quite picture a conversation between those two. And they have made several films together, because not only was there Gigli, let's not forget there was also Kevin Smith's Jersey Girl.
Oh, right.
And yet I still can't quite imagine just those two at home. You know, and like her going to him with like, I have an idea. And he's like, sounds great, babe. Like, I just want to know.
There was a video. I feel like there was a video going around this week. Maybe it got lost in all the debacle about the Wonka experience in Glasgow, but there was a video of them talking like outside about something, and it's kind of exactly that. I think they're unlike anybody we know, but they're all they also seem remarkably casual.
I mean, I love that for them. You know, I want nothing but the best for her. And this album, I will admit, has grown on me over time. You know, do you enjoy the album?
Yes. Can you say a little bit about seeing Jennifer Lopez in Vegas?
Yes. When I saw J-Lo, her residency in Vegas back in like, let's say like 2018-ish, it was one of like the greatest shows I've ever seen. The showmanship was just next level. Her she of course is first known as a dancer. She goes so hard with the choreo on every song. She is so meticulous. You can tell she holds herself. She's an extremely high standard. You forget how many hit songs she has until she's performing all of them in a row. She's a natural born superstar, of course. When you're around her, you are just like, I am being pulled into your orbit. You are a galaxy unto yourself. You know, it was just wonderful. It was truly one of the best live shows I've ever seen. So I have nothing but respect for her. And I think this album, when I first heard it, I was a little like turned off just because I was hoping for just more sort of like big bangers. But that's not what she's going for this album. It's like, it's more of like, it's a deliberate throwback to the This Is Me Then era, where she was kind of doing these sorts of nods to sort of 70s soul mixed with like early 2000s sort of hip hop production value. Like, it's a very distinct sound that I feel like she kind of owns.
I think so too.
And she really, I think, returns to that sound very effectively on this album.
Yeah. Yeah. It does give a lot of that. It puts you right back where you need to be with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. You know, there are tickets on sale now. She's going on tour with this. She's coming here. You want to go?
Maybe. You know, helps you get right, if you will. where is she playing out there?
It's a newish place called Acrisure Arena. It's where I saw Stevie Nicks. It's on top of a ice hockey rink.
Oh.
So bring a jacket. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we can take this offline and discuss further.
No, commit to me now in front of everybody that you're going to go, or I'm going to replace you.
I know. You already have your army of gays there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to see Madonna tomorrow night, so I have to clear that before I can start thinking about any other big diva shows.
Okay.
But I mean, it was, you're like, listen, why do you think I asked you to see how great it was? So I could be like, Sammy, you said it's a great show. Why would you see it again? bad faith questions. She's the best. And I mean, also, even, you know, to whatever degree that she is like a, you know, quote unquote, like delusional diva, I love her for that too.
Mm.
Like, I don't want to live in a world where we don't have like a Jennifer Lopez self-financing a $20 million passion project about her romantic history.
Or Dakota Johnson throwing away $20 million from Sony just to have a passion project to continue to be herself. Ladies, keep being yourself.
Keep doing it. Those are just the rules of feminism. Keep being yourself. Take it. Take what you can and just keep shining bright, you stars. We need you. Now more than ever, we need you.
Okay, so it's a binge it.
Binge
it's
it.
Very short. It's one of the shortest binges it we've had, and you won't regret it.
This and summoning Sylvia.
I think that's it.
That's it.
Thank you so much for listening. Jason, let's get back on here pretty soon.
Yes. I have my podcasting room back, and there's movies to be seen. So we'll be back at the exact time that we intend to be.
Exactly. Not a minute later. Thank you so much for listening, and take care.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Binging on movies with Rebecca and Jason.
You made it to the end. That's amazing. There goes the binge.